Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Happy April, everyone. My name is Renee Powers, and I'm the founder of Feminist Book Club, where we celebrate all things feminism and books. Thanks for joining me again today. I'm curious, now that only a handful of us are still commuting, where are you listening to your podcast these days? I plowed through maybe 20 episodes in my podcast queue yesterday while I was packing up all of our April boxes, but I found myself getting super behind and it's stressing me out. But also everyone's references to, haha, maybe we'll be quarantined, that'll be fun. Those references didn't age well a week later, but here we are. So let me know where you're listening. Hit us up on social media. Instagram is best. You can slide into our DMs or leave a comment on the post for this episode, but we're on Twitter and Facebook and newly on Pinterest as well. The bulk of our April boxes went out into the world yesterday. We filled up an entire USPS van, which was fun. But you haven't missed out on them yet. You can still order your April box until April 5th. And after that, if there are any left over, they'll go up to $45 and they'll be in our shop. Honestly, I only have 5 or 6 left, so if you want one, get on this. We're reading These Witches Don't Burn by Isabel Sterling, and all the products in this month's box have an environmental theme in mind, since April is Earth Month, and I think Mother Earth is really loving us for all the self-isolating these days. So if you're interested in this month's box, navigate to the FBC shop at feministbookclub.com and be sure to use code podcast for a little discount. COVID-19 has stolen a lot from us, and for book lovers, one of the most heartbreaking things is the cancellation of so many author events. Today's featured book is set to come out next week, but our author, Sahara Mustafa, won't be able to do any tour stops or events to get the word out. This book, The Beauty of Your Face, is truly a masterpiece. It's one of those that has the potential to be everywhere, from Oprah to Jenna to Reese to any number of subscription boxes. But who knows in these strange times we're in? So we're doing our part at Feminist Book Club to support these debut authors. We're excited to have Sahar on the show today, and we're also giving away a copy of her gorgeous novel. You can find a link to enter in our show notes as well as in our Instagram bio. So make sure you enter to win that and follow Sahar on all the social media and pick up this book if you don't win. It is beautiful. Before we get to today's interview, I have to give a content warning. This book and our conversation do venture into gun violence and school shootings, so please take care of yourself. Now, here's our interview. Welcome back, everyone. Today, I'm sitting down with Sahar Mustafa. Sahar is the daughter of Palestinian immigrants, a complex inheritance she explores in her work. Her prize-winning short story collection from 2017, Code of the West, is followed by her first novel, The Beauty of Your Face, and she writes and teaches outside of Chicago. Welcome, Sahar.
Thank you. I really am excited to be here, Renee.
I can't wait to talk more about The Beauty of Your Face. I devoured it and can't stop thinking about it. It's one of those. And but first, I have to ask you, what is your definition of feminism?
For me, feminism is elevating, protecting, supporting women and marginalized communities. So I'm really trying to focus even my own energy on intersectionality. And that came from, you know, just really positive and sometimes negative experiences within different kinds of communities. So I think that is probably a broad definition, but I feel like it sort of encapsulates even, you know, what I'm interested in and the work that I write, even if it's fiction.
And I'm sure that a lot of this is inspired by your own experiences too. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit about your positionality and how that influences your work?
So I've always identified as Arab woman first, which, you know, I've been thinking about a lot just because I've been in situations, particularly at school. We're doing a lot of diversity training. And it's made me really reflect on the different identities, you know, that I hold in the single body. And it's had me really reflect seriously on how being an Arab woman might also mirror the experiences of other individuals, not necessarily, you know, exact daily experiences, but in terms of oppression, in terms of bigotry, in terms of lack of resources or lack of support. And that's probably that piece on intersectionality that I talked about just a few moments ago. Mm-hmm. So in my work, of course, my characters are, you know, mostly Arab American or Palestinian or native Palestinians, but I think they still in some way are going to speak to those experiences of oppression and discrimination, particularly being Palestinian.
So talk to me a little bit about your book. So all of our listeners are on the same page. What is The Beauty of Your Face about? What can readers expect? Mm-hmm.
So it is my first novel, and it's framed by a hate crime shooting in an Islamic American school. And that school is a fictitious one. It is situated just outside of Chicago. And what happens is a white male shooter enters the school. So what happens is after that first section, it flashes back, and the rest of the novel becomes this episodic journey of her life, beginning in the 1970s. She is the child of Palestinian immigrants, and in that first chapter, her sister disappears. I won't do any spoiler alerts, but every decade then moves us towards how she arrives at this school, Nur al-Din School for Girls. But it's also intertwined with the shooter's perspective, not as extensively. So the shooter's perspective also serves as the time frame for the shooting for all practical purposes and handles that. So with Athaf's chapters in those episodes, I deliberately chosen a present tense so that it is more engaging. So that story of Athaf and how she eventually comes face to face with the shooter is the important culmination by the time we arrive there.
What I love about books like this, one of my favorite literary devices, is when we start a book and we're introduced to something big, something like the school shooting, which is such a timely and harrowing and horrifying experience for so many Americans right now. Layered with this, you know, anti-Muslim sentiment and this radical alt-right whiteness from the shooter, it's one of those where you start reading and you're like, oh shit, this is gonna be like, hold on to your butt, yes. This is gonna be good.
Yes.
And then we go back, and so you introduce us to this what happens at the end, right? And then we go back and we learn about the character. And so it becomes even, it's plot driven at the beginning, and then it becomes this kind of character study mm-hmm. about Afaf and her experience. And I loved diving into her as a character. What can you tell me about Afaf and writing her? And I'm assuming you became very close to her as well.
Yeah. And this is why my first draft failed with publicists and publishers don't always want me to talk about, you know, because obviously, you know, it's being published, but it's like one of those things where you don't need to talk about what didn't work, but it's necessary because of what you just stated, Renee. I had originally written, it was going to be, you know, a frame still by a hate crime shooting, but I had multiple Arab Muslim characters and I just couldn't get close to them. And so I had this experience where I wrote a significant draft, I would call it. But now I look back and I say, well, it was probably more an exploratory draft, and then had an epiphany because I just put it down and I just didn't feel like it was successful. I realized that what I hadn't been doing was going back to the beginning of the protagonist, the main character story. And it became Afaf essentially. So I wanted to focus on one human being and really take audiences back into the stories that comprise, you know, her journey. I'm really about, where do we come from? What are the forces that, you know, carry us to this moment in time? And I've given space to the shooter as well. But with Afaf, it was just such an amazing experience. You know, it is inevitable that some of her comes from, you know, some personal experiences or people who are close to me, and then the stories within my own community. And of course, I'm the story, the daughter of immigrants too. So I've got that, you know, sort of inside track. So it was absolutely amazing. And it allowed me again to tell what I consider is another kind of narrative. So as far as I know, this book is unique. So yes, we are in this moment of hate crimes and bigotry, Islamophobia, and just, you know, gun violence in schools. And that appealed to me also as a teacher. But I think I hope it also reveals to audience that there are just so many stories coming from this community, you know, and it's not a monolith. You know, I don't mean to also be representative, you know, and I'm not going to be the spokesperson. So AFAF allows me to maintain that sense of a unique human experience, but then there are going to be things that are just so transcendent. So I think in the end, I hope that people feel a sense of, you know, here's what it's like to be a good friend. Here's what it feels like to not belong to places, you know, here's what it's like to have a dysfunctional family, you know, and all that, that's the good stuff, right? But I wanted to make sure that, you know, I told Afaf's story as authentically and as meaningfully and in a way that was really engaging, you know, for audiences. I think some things that I've heard so far is that, you know, some people, you know, would have liked to have skipped over like the shooter's, you know, plot line. And I think that's really interesting. But I also feel like that story also needs to be in place and needs to be told. I could have easily have just written a story just about Afaf, but the framing of the hate crime still connects me to what inspired the book, which was the three murders in North Carolina, in Chapel Hill, of Yusor Abu Salha, her husband and her sister, by their neighbor, you know, by a white neighbor. So I've sort of, you know, I was so rattled by that and still am. And that was sort of the seed, you know, that germinated this novel.
Mm. One of the things I really appreciated was Afaf's grappling with faith. She comes from a fairly secular family.
Yes.
And finds Islam and finds peace in Islam. What do you say to that? I mean, what is...
Sure.
I want to talk about that, but I don't know what questions to ask.
Yeah. I love that. You know what? When I was thinking about talking with you, Renee, I thought about, what is exactly feminist about Afaf? You know, because it seems so counter-feminist. Anything having to do with, you know, religious institutions, organized religion. But the thing with Afaf, and again, I feel like this is maybe a new narrative for folks, is that it's not just a typical first generation, I'm going to rebel against my Arab family. They just don't get me. I want to be completely American. Why can't I just be completely American? What happens with Afaf is she's shut out of any sort of community, and even in the white community. So it's not even that she wants to assimilate, she wants to belong. And because her family is really struggling, you know, and it is, I would say, accurately described as secular. They're not atheists. I think that, you know, I've heard in that is not accurate in the way that I felt that I wrote them. It's just sort of a void, you know, in their lives. So religion just does not play an important role, a meaningful role. So Afaf comes to Islam through women. And to me, that is feminist. So she embraces the women who embrace her first, and then this love of God, all the things that become these beautiful, you know, rituals within Islam, to me just feel like the icing, you know, on the cake. But it's really this circle of women, as I refer to them in the novel, who accept her for who she is. In fact, they don't even ask who she was, you know, who she's coming to them as. You know, she's just been so, you know, destructive to herself, to her body, and has felt really just alienated and just on the fringes, even within her Arab community when we get to her high school years, and just does not belong. And when she meets Goka, this wonderful, you know, young adult who invites her and says, you know, why don't you join? Why don't you give this a chance? It's not really praying, you know, the fasting. It's these women first who just love her and offer her a place to start over, you know, and then lead her to her career in education. And it's really beautiful, beautiful, you know, to see unfold. And that's what's been missing. So even just like that community of strong women, quite poignantly, surrogate mothers for her.
Yeah. And that's not even something we've talked about yet, is her relationship mm-hmm. with her mother. But I want to go back to this. You said something that piqued my interest about faith and feminism mm-hmm. and how there's this assumption that those two can't coexist.
Yeah. Especially in Islam, I would say. Yes.
Yes. Because there's this white feminism, especially, is all about saving the other, right? Mm-hmm. That Muslim women are oppressed and they have to wear the hijab and the burqa, and there's no agency for Muslim women to have a voice. And we see there's this beautiful scene where Afaf has grown. She's a young woman now. She's been in the Muslim community for several years, and she decides that she wants mm-hmm. to wear the hijab. And it was one of those scenes that just gave me complete goosebumps. Oh. It was such a beautiful moment. And again, we're relying on the women around her to make meaning of this, to support her, to encourage her. And it felt to me, like you said, less an act of stringent faith.
Doctrine.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Dogma. Right. And more of, I want to give back to this community who has given me so much.
Yeah.
It was so human.
Oh, I'm so glad. And, you know, for me, I really loved writing that scene. I think in the end, too, Afaf comes to these kinds of decisions on her own terms and in her own, you know, good time. I think what's so important about that is now becoming visibly Muslim. So that's also this decision that she's making. So again, that speaks to, she loves being part of this community. And now here's the next step. And then what is that going to mean? What is that going to cost, you know, for someone like her? I just remember, Renee, attending parties of hijab like that. So that actually comes from some experiences. I've actually never worn hijab, but I've attended parties. And of course, that's, you know, those are great because you feel just so much inspiration. But I just remember just, you know, they were so wonderfully celebratory. And for Afaf, though, that is still, it's sort of tainted when she leaves the party, when, of course, now she goes into, you know, white America and Anglo-Christian America, and this is now going to be, you know, life from now on. But she's strong, and that strength has developed from that circle of women. So, you know, she's ready and she does it. And I think it's pretty spectacular to me whenever that decision is made. And I'm just so in awe of women who go out every day, you know, in quite a volatile, you know, climate than in my experience has ever been since 9/11, I would say, and are still showing up, you know, and not surrendering and, you know, relinquishing their hijab. I think it's amazing.
Yeah. And that's a radical feminist act in itself.
Yeah, it really is. Really is.
Let's go back to the beginning. Question gnawing at me, and there's no good segue for it. Her sister goes missing.
Yes.
Right at the beginning.
Yeah.
I think I know why that mm-hmm. was a decision of yours, but I want to hear from you what inspired that and what was that, what was the purpose of it?
Yeah. And that's one of those subplot lines that I think really keep readers gripped, and I hope it's not, you know, the way it unfolds, I hope it's not disappointing. So it actually served a few purposes for me. First one being, I was a child of the 70s. Of course, I was born in 73, so I was a younger child. But that experience of the sister, you know, disappearing came to me because of stories of girls going missing in our community. So I remember very vividly my sister's best friend just showing up and just sobbing and sharing the news that, you know, her sister was gone. Now, I frame it as Neda disappearing, and I'll leave it at that. But I wanted to show the experiences of her immigrant parents who are trying to basically navigate, you know, raising children, let alone then losing a child. And Afaf, you know, sort of viewing her parents as incompetent and not being able to, you know, sort of protect them, her sister, and all the things that she had to do to basically, you know, help her mother through systems and basically things that were left to her father, like registering them for school. So for me, it was a good opportunity to sort of depict those experiences and how difficult it was to be what I imagine an immigrant parent, you know, in this country in the 70s when those resources were really, you know, not available. And then the experience of someone like me in real life, you know, also taking on the role of a parent. There's also, I think, some pretty, I think, strong examples of the bigotry too, in the way, you know, the police officers, you know, handle the situation and all those things. I did not want to be lost, you know, on readers, and how different it might have been had it been maybe, you know, a white young person going missing, you know. So I hope that answers the question of placing that first. But and lastly, that becomes the grief that the mother is just devastated by. And I'm really interested in experiences of grief and how they are complicated also, I think, by geography, in terms of Muntaha, her mom, being in a country that she just doesn't feel like she belongs to, does not want to stay in, and then having to lose a daughter in this country, you know, rather than being with her support network, which would be in Palestine, you know, and how that really just makes things worse. And then that inevitably trickles down to Afaf and her brother. Yeah. And what it's like every day living with loss and grief, which then gets us into the mental health issues.
Yeah. And it sounds like, to, you know, listeners who haven't read this yet, it sounds like there's a lot in this book. Mm-hmm. We've got mental health. We've got a missing sister. We've got a school shooting. We've got faith and Islam. But I will tell you what.
Yeah.
Everybody's just like, what is this novel?
Yeah. Yeah.
Concise and beautifully done. And it provides just a really rich reading experience. And like I said, you just get to know these characters, and it's just the histories. And I think you mentioned you wanted to create a really authentic experience of Afaf's life. And I think that's exactly what you've done, is you've painted this portrait of a complicated human. And
oh, I'm glad.
An experience. So I commend you for that. And I want to tell the listeners,
you,
it's not too much.
Yes. Yeah, you know, I think that is where the episodes work really well. So for all practical purposes, I think I could have maybe sent, you know, parts of this book out and presented them as short stories, you know, or self-contained chapters. So I'm glad to hear that it's just enough, but I'm also not averse to readers being on the edge and, you know, the tension really just building. But I also like to think I've managed those threads in a way that there aren't too many things that feel jarring or dropped, I hope. And that, of course, is the craftsmanship that I really wanted to pay attention to in a novel like this, the journey over decades.
You mentioned that the first version of this had several stories. What happened to those? Mm-hmm.
Those characters mostly remained in present tense. And I think that's probably why they didn't work. I'll say this, a few of those characters still remain very interesting to me. So I think there might be other stories that, you know, I might revisit, but they just didn't hold this novel experience in the way, I suppose, that The Beauty of Your Face ended up doing. I think it was important to follow one human being, to sort of have Afaf embody unique experiences, but then again, familiar experiences. I think my own community, you know, they're going to be able to find things that resonate, you know, very closely and intimately with them. So yeah, I haven't, you know, it's not completely, you know, tossed. That's the great thing with electronic files and such, you know. I am glad that it sort of flopped and I felt terrible about it. It was one of those things where I had gone through years experience in this writing workshop to come to the summertime when I could really devote my time to writing since I'm not teaching full time. And then to, you know, sort of not have anything because it just failed. And I just sort of sulked. And then of course, I think really just maybe 2 or 3 weeks before I started teaching again that, you know, I had this revelation and was waking up then at 4 a.m. and just couldn't stop. And then, you know, it's working, you know, when the writing just takes off, and it was amazing. So I'm really happy to say that the writing went quickly. When I hear how some writers have worked on a book for years, you know, sometimes I feel self-conscious about admitting that. It was not, you know, more than a few years that I finally got this to where it needed to be. But it's because of how many things clicked. And I just ran with them. And it was just really, really cool.
I really appreciate you saying that, you know, you focused your summer on it because you do teach. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions that I see a lot from readers is, how do writers do it? Do they make a lot of money from sales, mm-hmm. and that supports them full time? Do they have part-time jobs? Do they work full time? And yeah. I think that you sharing that just illustrates that writers are people too.
Yes. And, you know, my students, I teach seniors, and then I have a mix of creative writing classes, and those usually will be comprised of sophomores through seniors. And they are just so adorable about, does this mean you're not coming back, Miss M, when this gets out there? And I'm like, you know, guys, you know, it would have to reach like, you know, J.K. Rowling, like Stephen King, like, you know, I need Oprah to call me. And then, you know, we could have a conversation again. But I tell them that here's what's so wonderful is that this has become another life, you know, that I'm living. And if nothing else, I hope that it shows students that you can do multiple things, that, you know, you can have, you know, multiple careers, whatever that looks like, but you could still have something that pays the bill, which I hope is still meaningful. That's what teaching has always been for me. I'm also someone who believes that being a teacher, the experiences that I've had have basically all put me on this path to where I'm at today, good and bad, you know, whatever those experiences and episodes were, but that I can cultivate this other kind of life. And it's just been terrific. So in some ways, maybe I'm a late bloomer because, you know, I've been in cohorts with very young writers, you know, but it doesn't matter, you know, when you come to it, you know, I think it matters the story that you are ready to tell, and to tell it in the best way you can. And there'll be an audience for it. It's making that decision. And sure, I have to be disciplined during the school year. I'm also at a place where I'm an empty nester. So, you know, my children are young adults and I'm very cognizant of this. So I give a lot of credit to young mothers who are writing, you know, young parents who are writing. I'm in a really, you know, super time of my life where, you know, here I can talk to you, Renee, and I don't have young children, you know, running around calling to me. It's been just, you know, really fruitful and productive. And so that I guess, again, you know, also proves that it's a journey, that there were times where I'd have to wait, you know, for my younger daughters to be asleep when I was first starting to write, you know, seriously. And, you know, now everything seems to be falling in place, you know, and I'm grateful. And I'm also mindful, you know, of those things.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such a privilege to be able to have those long swaths of time to devote to your writing. I love high school students, and I love that you're a high school teacher. And I can imagine that writing about a school shooting as a high school teacher is probably really difficult. I imagine if it were me, I would be seeing the faces of my students as I was writing this. And in fact, I had a few nightmares. I read before bed. And when I was reading your book, I had a couple of nightmares as I was reading it about school shootings. And that's not to say don't read this again everybody mm-hmm. must read it.
Yes, yes.
It's because it is such a horrible epidemic that we're experiencing mm-hmm. as a country over the last decade or so. How do you grapple with that?
Yeah, no, this is a good question. I imagine some people might not want to pick up the book because they're worried about that component, but it's not terribly graphic. I think I was pretty true, you know, when the shooter enters the building and then the unfolding events after. Here's the thing. For me, I think I'm grappling with two separate kinds of gun violence. One being gun violence in schools with young active shooters, so to speak. So it's a student, for example, bringing a gun, which I've written about. And I would say that earlier short story has also sort of found its way into this novel. And then the other kind of violence is because of Islamophobia, is because of racism, because of bigotry. So I don't know if there's one answer I can give about how I deal with that as much as when I was approaching the novel, I definitely wanted to be as authentic with details. And those come straight from my active shooter training and from, you know, the things that I have heard about, read about, and then have had to, you know, research. And I have to say, those were difficult moments. So having to research the alt-right, and I read a book called One of Us, which is sort of a journalistic, you know, this memoir of a real life Norwegian shooter. And that was really enlightening. I felt like, those kinds of books also revealed it's not just this sort of stock male shooter, that they are quite nuanced and they are quite complex. And that's not to justify or excuse, it's truly to help us understand those decisions to pick up a gun. You know, you're not just going to wake up one morning and pick up a gun. There's going to be just a series of traumatic events, I think, that occur, you know, to a single human being. So when I think about Parkland, for example, I'm glad that there was, you know, certainly, talk about the young man who apparently, you know, had major mental health issues. So my feeling as an educator is, when do we begin to seriously address those things? You know, so what compels a young person to bring a gun to school? And I've actually written about that too in essays mostly. So yes, I am definitely, you know, cognizant and sensitive. It was hard, you know, at times writing, but I didn't want to shy away because ultimately, I felt like I needed to tell this story. And anyone who rejected me early on in the query process, who said things like that, you know, one agent very, you know, swiftly said, "Sahar, I'm sorry, I don't have the stomach to read this. Good luck with it." And I felt like, in some ways, very sadly, you know, that was like, it felt to me like white publishing industry trying to control the narrative. And I wasn't having it, Renee. And I thought, I need to stick with this. So, and then I had other editors and agents who said, why don't you drop the, you know, shooter plot line and let's focus on this as an immigrant story. And I thought, once again, you know, there's that control and this turning away from something that, you know, might not ostensibly be a threat to white society, but is very much the concern of any, you know, visible Muslim. So again, just, yeah, so many ways of, you know, looking at gun violence and hate crimes. I hope that gives you, you know, some idea of what I've been thinking about, even as this book is about to launch, you know, and the reaction. So in many ways, that's timely, but there are human beings still who emerge in this novel that I think will always stay with readers. And from what, you know, you've experienced, I think, yeah, you know, that won't be lost. So it's political in many ways, you know, I'm addressing, you know, really timely social issues, but behind them are very human faces and stories.
I want to go down this rabbit hole of publishing and white publishing. Mm-hmm. And I'm reminded of, I believe it was Mira Jacob who I had this conversation with on the podcast. Mm-hmm. I'll try to dig it up and put it in the show notes, but I believe it was her who said that she had a publisher say, this is too many stories. Let's mm-hmm. do it as an immigrant story. Let's do, yeah. let's, you know, published this as a coming of age story. And she was like, why can't it be all of it? Immigrants are all of these things. Like, I don't understand why we have to just be an immigrant story or just be a love story.
I'm definitely feeling that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm, as someone who hasn't published anything and I've never had that experience with publishers and I am a white person, it's not something that I have to experience. And so it's one of those, when I hear stories of that, it's surprising and jarring, but also not surprising and disappointing all at the same time. So we're coming up at the end of our time together. Mm-hmm. So I want to say that you've written a lot of essays. You also have a short story collection. All of that is on your website.
Yes.
Your essays.
Some things are also individual pieces that are immediately accessible.
Yeah.
All my information's on my website. And I'm also on Twitter at Sahara Mustafa.
And we will link that in the show notes. And your website is just saharamustafa.com.
Yes.
And if you have a book to recommend to our listeners that's not your own, what would you like them to read?
So are you just asking for one, Renee?
Okay, I could.
Well, you know what? Here's the thing. And of course, I'm sure, you know, writers have listen. Here's how I'll present it. What I'm reading in this moment, so things that I've just read that have been terrific. Actually, I'll do just three.
Okay.
One is 10 minutes, 38 seconds in the strange world by Elif Shafak. And she is a Turkish British writer. And that one was just fantastic. And Highway of Tears, which is nonfiction. And that one is by Jessica McDiarmid and was just so brutal and necessary. A novel that I've read much later than other folks would be La Rose by Louise Erdrich. And, you know, I've definitely had, you know, a sort of survey education to Erdrich, but that book was just so moving and poignant. And so I would want to put that on my list of, you know, the longer list of here's what you should read. And then the other two being my immediate picks.
And Louise Erdrich is local here to the Twin Cities. And she actually has a new book coming out that I'm really excited about too.
Oh, great. I'll be looking out for that because now I've gone backwards.
Well, this has been absolutely delightful. Thank you so much for sharing so much of this book with us and your insight on the writing process. This has just been really, really easy to talk to. And I appreciate that.
But I'm glad.
So insightful too. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been so fun, Renee.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.